John.
All right, Bobby. Give him hell, Bobby. Give him hell, Bobby.
My name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic.
Bobby.
And congratulations on 38 years.
Bobby.
You know, a group of 38 years has helped a lot of people, not just the alcoholics, right? But the friends of the alcoholics and the employers and employees of the alcoholics. I sure learned some Greek parts and very great from the I'll go right into my story very fast. I attended my first AA meeting in 1957. And I was just a kid. I'm just a kid now, but I mean, I was more of a kid then, right? And there were six or seven people there, that's all it was. And there was a guy up here talking, and his name was Hal. I remember that. And he, can you hear me at the back?
No.
Good, because I can hear you. Carol was up here speaking, and Harold said he was an alcoholic. And you know, he looked exactly what I thought an alcoholic should look like. He was an old guy, and he had a big, fat nose, you know, and a pot belly, and a pot money. You could have hung him up once and said, don't let this happen to you. Join AA. And he was out there, he was talking about all the stuff he drank. He said, I drank smoke, and I drank Rubby Dub, and I drank Musky Doo, and I had no idea what he was talking about. I had no idea. I never drank any. I drank only brand, you know, liquids, right? Aqua Belva, Red Cap Refresher, Listerine, maybe a little bit of shellac thinner, but you had to cut that with holy water to keep yourself alive. And I didn't understand what he was talking about. That was in 1957. I bounced in on this program from 1957 till 1961. In 1961, I was 29 years old. On July 15th, 1961, I collapsed in front of the green light of the green, whatever the heck. What was the name of that place over there? The green door, is it?
Green lounge.
The green, you won't remember, so. You were one of the regulars, right? I collapsed over there, and they sent the EMTs, and one of the EMTs, who wasn't quite as bright as anybody else, he pronounced me dead. It was a mistake, as you can see. And the other guy said, well, you know, before we put a toe tag on him, let's see if we can revive him. And they revived me, and they took me over to God, the St. Mental Hospital. And I stayed over there for a couple of days, and a couple of people from the Lemonster Group, a guy who became my sponsor, Al, and the lady he hung around with by the name of Jeanette, picked me up and took me up to Marion Johnson. Now, if nobody here remembers Marion Johnson, she ran a farm up in Dublin, New Hampshire. It was called Birch Acres. And she probably put 15,000, 16,000 people through there very inexpensively. You know, I think it cost you $85 a week to go there, right? But I didn't have any money. And if it's going to cost $85 a week to go to a dry out place, you know, if I had $85 in my pocket, why would I go to a dry out place? You know, I'm not ready to go there until I get rid of the $85. So I went up there, and I come out of there. I had my last drink on the front steps of Marion Johnson's on July 17th, 1961. A little over 46 years ago, right? Now, before everybody gets excited about the fact that they've been sober 46 years, I've only been sober for a day, right? Understand that. I see all these people get up and get their chips, and God bless you. Thank you so much for coming up and participating in the program. But it's a daily program. It has nothing to do with longevity. None of us are here to see how long we can stay sober. If you don't drink today and you don't die today, you can have 150 years if you live that long, right? But the problem is, people come in here, like I did, and say, and I was 26, 27 when I first arrived, I thought I had to stop drinking for the rest of my life. You know, that's what I have to do. I have to, and the rest of my life, when you're 26 years old, well, you're going to live to be at least 300. You know, you got all kinds of things that are going to happen. You know, it has to be broken down to a day at a time. And it was a day at a time that saved my life. It's a disease of denial, right? We mentioned that. And I was in tremendous denial. I'll show you what denial is. By the time I got here, I've been arrested, hospitalized, institutionalized. I've been locked in, locked up, locked out. I've been in my house trying to get out. I've been out of my house trying to get in. I've had the shakes, the sweats, the dry heat, the wet heat, the DTs, the heart, I was covered with line sores and had to put, my money was gone, my family was gone, my bowels weren't working, my teeth were falling out. There was nothing left in my life, and I was living in a Goodwill box over on 8th Avenue alone. And I said to myself, well, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, yeah. That's not, but you know, you say, well, he's taking denial to the extreme. No, I'm not taking denial to the extreme. There are people who are dying every day of this disease. Every single day they're dying because they've been denied. Right? That's taking it to the extreme. You know, they don't want to admit they've got the problem. You know, and the reason we don't want to admit the problem is alcoholics is, in my view, we think that alcohol is the solution to the problem. We think it's a solution. It's not the answer. Right? I thought my problem was bad nerves. I thought my problem was insecurity. You know, I people say they come from a dysfunctional family. I didn't come from any family at all. Right? I was left at Hanover Hospital in Worcester. I was born there with my brother. I had a twin brother. And they left us there. They never bothered to pick us up. When they called the telephone number, whatever it was a wrong number. You know? And I was made a ward of the state and bounced around for a while. And I didn't have a family at all. That's not the reason I'm here. That's not the reason I'm here. The circumstances that in my early childhood were not what made me an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I drink. I'm an alcoholic because I love to drink. I love to drink. I didn't come here because I hated the stuff. I love to drink. You know, I could use it for a hair tonic, underarm deodorant, whatever, you know. It was wonderful stuff. But it ultimately let me down. It let me down. I don't know what social drinking is. I've never been a social drinker. I don't understand social drinking, right? I married a woman many years ago. She's a social drinker. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. We used to go to a party and somebody would say, would you like something to drink? Do you know that sometimes she said no? No. The only time I ever said no was when she said, have you had enough? No, not yet. And then she ordered this thing. I think she called it a white Russian or something. It looked like a milkshake, and she had trees in there and logs and, you know, all kinds of, you know, right? And she takes a sip of it and she goes, oh, that's very strong. Wait, there's nothing in it. And then she'd leave half of it because, oh, I think it's going to my head. Unbelievable. So I had to draw an analogy to find out what a social drinker is, how they think. Okay? So like this morning I got up and I had a bowl of wheat. Okay. No, I didn't have the second bowl. Well, maybe I did. I don't really recall. See how that works? I don't know whether I had the second bowl or not. But I know one thing. When I go out of here tonight and I'm driving down past the lake here, heading down towards the roadie, if a dog jumps out in front of me, and I slammed the brakes on my car, 13 empty Wheaties boxes are not going to slide out. I don't have any spare plates in my pocket. I'm a social Wheaties eater. They could take it off the market. Maybe 5 or 6 months ago, I wouldn't even know it. And when I discover, who cares, I'll leave Captain Crunch. But I'm not that way when it comes to drinking, and I never was that way. I remember my first drink. You know, we have 12 steps in the program about that. And the first 3 steps are the steps where we own up to the fact that we got the problem, that we have the problem, right? And I like to draw an analogy between those first 3 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the first 3 steps of alcoholism. Right? I was a very nervous kid, right? I was brought up in New Hampshire, up in Concord, Claremont, up above there. Ultimately, I moved down to Watertown. I had some talent when it came to music. I studied with a member of the Boston Symphony. At a very young age, I went on the road with the name band, traveling around the country. But I was too nervous. You know, I used to have anxiety attacks. Horrible, and if you've never had an anxiety attack, you don't know what it is. And if you have, you know it's indescribable. It's totally indescribable, right? And I have anxiety attacks on the bandstand at night, you know, in front of 3,500 people. You know, and I had a difficulty playing. I was in a section. I played a brass instrument in a section in these big bands, and you got a phrase in the section. I couldn't even breathe. How could I breathe, right? And so I started taking drinks before I went on the stage, right? And then I started having anxiety attacks at 5 o'clock in the afternoon worrying about the 9 o'clock anxiety attack. And then I'd have an anxiety attack at 10 o'clock in the morning worrying about the 5 o'clock. And I was in the turmoil all the time. And I realized I had to get out of the business, you know? They don't take it for putting in the mentor. You got to get out the stage in front of people, and I couldn't do that. So I got back to Massachusetts. I got a job in Boston working in a band down there, in a house band. You know? And down there, I had an anxiety attack one night that I couldn't control. And it was building and building, and I'm trying to fight it down. And my heart's going a million miles a minute, and my hands are curling up, and I fainted. And they took me up to the back of the hall, and a bartender gave me a water glass full of Corby's whiskey. I mean, remember it like it was 2 minutes ago. He poured that whiskey into that glass, and he said, "Here, sip this, it'll make you feel better." Now, I'm a nervous wreck. My life is totally, completely, and absolutely unhappy. I'm a mess, and I haven't never had a drink. And he gave me this thing, and he said, "Sip it." And I knew I shouldn't do it. This is an Irish-French Catholic disease. I was brought up a Baptist. Thanks for letting me in. And Baptists don't drink. I don't know if you know that. Baptists don't do anything. You can't even play Sashiji on Sunday. If you're born a Baptist, the best thing to do is after you pop out, just lay there. And they'll find someone who will look at his knees in a lascivious position. I took the drink. I sipped it. That's what he told me to do. You know, it was raw whiskey that burned all the way down the river. All the way down. And there was a little explosion here. The explosion, the world's color went up into my arms, and it was going down in my legs, and it was up in my back. And I mean, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Right up here, that world, oh my God. This was wonderful. Where the hell have you been keeping this stuff? With every bit of warmth up my tumor, the anxiety, the fear, the terror, it all just drifted right away from me. And I felt wonderful for the first time in my life. If it was a woman that had done that to me, I would have been a sex maniac. But it was a booze admitted. Now, I had the first step of alcoholism that night. I told you my life was unmanageable. It was very unmanageable. And now I've taken a drink, right? And I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't know I was at that time, but I was to find out a few years later that I was powerless over alcohol. And that was the first step of alcoholism. It worked. You see what happens? It worked. It worked. It did what I wanted. There was a hole in my body when I was born, a hole in my soul, and it just plugged the hole up. It filled it up. And I felt I could function in life. I didn't have to be an insecure individual. Just give me some of that. Where have you been hiding this stuff? Right? And so I took the second step of alcoholism that night. I came to believe that there was a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. They called it Corby's, and I drank. I got up next morning, I was sick. Of course I was sick. I never drank before, but I was no longer afraid. I went out and I bought some Corby's. I took the cap off the bottle, threw the cap away. I wasn't going to put it back on. I didn't bother to look at it. I drank it, and it worked just as well at 8 o'clock in the morning as it did at 8 o'clock at night. And I took the third step of alcoholism. I turned my life and my will over to the care of God as I understood him. And God as I understood him came in a bottle. You could buy it, you could steal it, you could drink it, and you could feel good. I developed an unbelievable faith in alcohol. An unshakable faith. If I had booze with me, I was all right. Sometimes I didn't even have to drink it, I just had to have it there. But if you took it away from me, I was a bundle of herbs. I fall apart. My God was a bottle of booze. Later on, I got involved with drugs. This is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I won't go into that. I used to get up and I say, "My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic and an addict." But somebody from the back of the hall one night yelled out, "Put $2 in the basket." He's one cheap, so I'm an alcoholic. Now, whatever happened to me, we all have a story. I have a story, you have a story, right? My story is probably, I wound up on the streets, like I said, you know. But, you know, my story doesn't make me an alcoholic any more than your story makes you an alcoholic. It's the alcoholism that creates the story. And when we put down the alcohol, we stop writing that story, right? And I wrote the story right from the time I was pronounced dead on the street. No, I came into AA. I finally got sober on July 17th, 1961. I had a sponsor. And I took that day, I took the first step. I admitted that day that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unnatural. First step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor said to me, how about the second step? We come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. I had no power greater than myself. The power greater than myself was in the bottle. Now you're taking it away from me and you're telling me, find another power. You want me to find another power? And not only that, this power that you're talking about is an abstract. It's not even something that'll happen. Booze works like this. Bam, bam, I'm okay. Right? You want to ask God for help? I ask God for help and I say, why didn't he listen to me? I had terrible, terrible obsession with alcohol. And the obsession wouldn't go away. And I said, I don't think I'm going to make this. And Harold said to me, you must have a higher power to turn to. It's a transference of faith. I said, Harold, I don't have one. He said, invent one. Here's the concept. I invented a power greater than myself. I call that power Sam. Not that Sam. He come to help me. He got all the way down there. Okay, just to hear you mention the name Sam. I call this guy Sam. Okay, I didn't believe in Sam. But every morning I got up and I asked Sam, would you help me through this day without a drink or a substance? That's what they told me to do. I had a gift of desperation. I needed to get some kind of help. I didn't know where to get it from. I'm dying. You know what it is? It's fine. They talk about long-term sobriety. I was at a meeting the other day, said, Bob's got long-term sobriety. Show what long-term sobriety is. Long-term sobriety is the first night you go without a drink. That's long-term sobriety. Longest night of the year, right? Longest night of your life, right? And I didn't believe. I didn't believe. But I kept asking. Now, I had my last drink on July 17th, 1961, like I said. I finally came to believe, the second step, I finally came to believe in October of 1966. 5 years and 3 months later, I kept asking for help. I kept asking for help from Sam. But I didn't believe in Sam. Why should I believe in Sam? Sam wasn't my creator. I created Sam. He was like a little cartoon character, right? And I created him and I asked him for help. But in asking him for help, I had turned my life and my will over to a power greater than myself that I assumed was Sam. And in Bolton, Massachusetts, in October of 1966, I had a spiritual awakening. You can believe it or not, doesn't make any difference. I don't care. Right? It was a beautiful day out. And the trees were ablaze, and I'm not a tree hugger. I don't go on kissing branches and hugging trunks, right? Well, at least not a tree trunk. And some of the people are slow to me. They didn't believe they're out there. But anyway, I had a spiritual awakening. I came to believe that Sam, and I rushed back to Chemsford where I was staying sober out there. And I said to my sponsor, I said, Sam works. Sam works. Right? Sam has been helping me to stay sober. He said, good. Now that you believe that, why don't you call him by his real name, God? Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've called him God. And I don't know who God is, or whether it's a man or a woman or a spirit. I have no idea what God is. Right? But you don't have to know what God is in order to believe that God is. You don't have to know what it is, or who it is, or how it is in order to know what it is. Right? I was up in Wolfbury not too long ago, and there was a discussion meeting up there, and they said, the topic of discussion was God as we understood it. And they said, how about you, God? You got 40-some-odd years of sobriety, right? How do you understand God? I said, I don't. Right? And they were all struck up. He doesn't. I saw a sign down in the Oklahoma City in Tampa, Florida, not too long ago. It said, I don't know, and neither do you. Right? And that's the truth. None of us really know what God is, right? But I'll tell you, we know that it is because it works. And if it didn't work, I wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here. Think about that. Right? I don't know how a cell phone works. I don't know how it works. I remember the first cell phone I had, I was driving out of Florida, I was down in Georgia or South Carolina or someplace, and my brother called me up from Kennebunk, Maine. And I picked up the phone and I said, "Hello." And he said, "Hi, where are you?" I said, "Where am I? You must know where I am, you just called me." I said, "I have no idea where you are." I said, "Well, how the hell did you call me?" He said, "I dialed your number." I don't know how a cell phone works, and if you do, don't tell me. I don't want to know. I got enough problems just finding how to get the numbers in there, right? But I know a cell phone works. I don't know how it works, you see? It's not necessary for me to know how it works. If the cell phone rings, pick it up. There's somebody in the other end. There's a power in this room tonight. Not because I'm here, not because we're here, right? Because all of us are here. There's a power in this room. I'd like to call the power of God. If it offends you, you can call it anything you want. You do not have to believe in God to make this program. Just be grateful he doesn't feel the same way about you. You know, there are things in this room tonight that we cannot see. Now think about this. If you're sitting there saying, "Well, that's all poppycock about God being in there," there are things in this room we can't see. What kind of music do you like? You like rap? You like jazz? You like classical? You like popular? What kind of music do you like? Because all that music is in this room right now. Can you hear it? You can't hear it? You know why you can't hear it? Because you don't have a radio. But if you turn the radio on, you can hear all that music. You got your choice of what you want. Do you think the music is in the radio? Of course not. The music is in the room. And the radio is the receiver. That's how we pick it up. And we have our choice of what we want to pick up. There are television pictures in this room. There are cell phones bouncing off the walls here. You got to have a cell phone in order to hear it. You got to have a television in order to see the pictures, but all of that is in this room tonight, and there's one more thing in this room tonight. There's a power greater than ourselves. And that power greater than ourselves is just as positive as a cell phone or as a radio or as a television. It's all there. It's all there. Right? But we have to tap into it. I went 5 years and 3 months because I didn't tap into it. I didn't want to believe in it. I thought it was an abstract. I thought it was something that couldn't help me. And once I came to believe, right, instantaneously, I've never had another anxiety attack. Because it's in the belief that you get the relief. The belief will give you the relief. We do this program a day at a time. People talk about surrender. You know when you surrender? Every morning. Every morning. You don't surrender once and then, "Oh, well, I surrendered." You know, you're not General Peck. Right? You surrender every morning to the fact that you are suffering from an alcoholic disease that wants to kill you. I got up this morning and I did the same thing that I've done for over 17,000 days. I asked the power greater myself to please help me through this day without a drink of a substitute. I did that this morning. When I go home tonight, I will thank that power. The same as they have done for the last 17,000 days. You know why I do that? Because it works. Because that's why I'm here. You know, you don't get up in the morning and walk out without your clothes on. You don't go walking down the main street of Leominster or Fitchburg naked. You have to put clothes on. Okay? And that's the law. You can't walk around naked. Well, I'll tell you what the law is in here in AA. If you want to be sober for today, you have to put your garments, your spiritual garments on. You have to get up in the morning and take the first three steps. I'm an alcoholic. I will be all day today. There is a power greater than myself, whether I believe it or not, and I'm asking that power to help me through this day. We dress ourselves in spiritual raiments so we can maintain our sobriety at the end of the night. It's very simple. And if you don't think this is fact, let it be just faith. Live it on faith alone. Let me tell you what faith means to me, then I'll sit back. Let me take it back to Lowell, 50-some-odd years ago. And it was early in the morning, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. I had no booze, and I had no drugs, and I had no money, and I had no friends. And I was dying. I weighed 102, 103 pounds. There was nothing left of me. My heart was beating. I was going to die any minute. Any minute. I'm shaking, I'm falling apart, and I'm beating on barroom doors. "Please, please, please, somebody open the door. I gotta get something to drink." And I knocked on one door, and And the guy in there, Looney, he opened up the door and he said, "What do you want, you bum?" And he didn't offend him. I said, "Ah, well, let me have something to drink. Will you give me something to drink?" He said, "Screw." And he did the only thing I thought would do, I begged him. I said, "Don't do that. Don't do that. Please, doctor, I'm dying out here. If you got any compassion, anything at all, please, please, just one drink. Please, please let me have something." And he went back inside and he got me a fifth of booze. He got me a fifth of booze. A fifth of booze. And he handed it to me. He said, "Go drink yourself to death, you drunk and fuck." And I didn't feel any shame or anything. I had that bottle of booze right there. You know? And instantly, my pulse went back to where it was supposed to be, and my blood pressure dropped, and I could feel the strength going right through my body. A smile probably crossed my face. It's going to be a wonderful day. Now, that transformed me from a raving maniac, right, beating on bottom doors to a serene human being. The booze, right? Of course not. It was faith. I simply believed that what was in that bottle would work for me. And because I believed it would work for me, it worked for me. If you're here tonight, if you've been here a thousand times before and are bouncing around, if this is your first time back, if you've been sober all kinds of years, it doesn't make any difference. Believe that what is in this room tonight will work for you. And if you can believe that, you'll have the greatest gift of loving God will ever give a drunk. 24 hours of sobriety. Thank you.
Good job, brother.